Recording has started. Speakers, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the PPSAI Working Group on the 15th of September, 2015. On the call today, we have Graham Bunton, Erganga Kanagama, Holly Leish, Val Sherman, Steve Metellitz, David Cake, Sarah Baki, James Bledel, Frank Michalik, Steve Metellitz, Alex Deacon, Lindsay Hamilton-Reed, Terry Stummy, Susan Kawaguchi, Todd Williams, and Roger Carney. We have apologies from Darcy Southwell, Stephanie Perrin, Susan Prosser, Phil Corwin, Don Blumenthal, Michaela Nyland, Sarah Wild, Kathy Kleinman, and Paul McGrady. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Marika Koning, Amy Bivens, Natalie Peregrin, and myself, Terry Agony. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and back over to you, Graham.
Thank you kindly. So this is Graham. I'll be chairing the call today. That certainly sounded like a good number of regrets for today's call, and you know, it still looks like we've got a reasonable number of people in the room, so we should be able to make some forward progress. Before we get that far, any updates to SOIs we should be made aware of and your weekly reminder to keep those up to date? Seeing no hands, on the agenda for today is that we're going to hear from sub-team 3, talking about the possible revisions to the Annexe illustrative disclosure framework and the work that they've been doing. And then if we get so far, we'll talk about any issues arising from Part 3 of the Working Group Public Comment Review Tool. Unless there's any issues with that agenda, probably dig right into it, and I'll call on someone from Sub-Team 3, which I suspect is going to be Todd, but I should probably call it that team has done a lot of good work, and it's really appreciated, and we should make sure to recognize that. I see Todd has his hand up. So, Todd?
Thanks, Graham. Todd Williams for the transcript. So, I think the easiest thing to do would be to just walk through this document. One point, though, that I would note, the document that we are looking at in the Adobe room is, I think, a little bit different from what we circulated on the broader group in that I'm not seeing the kind of comment boxes off to the side that we'd include to note which public comment that we reviewed these proposed changes were coming from. I mean, I can flag those as we go through them, but I would certainly encourage everybody in the working group to look at that. And again, just to kind of stress from the outset a note that I made in introducing this last week, you know, this is our intention is that this is more of an illustrative tool to kind of illustrate or point out if, you know, we as a working group decide that the public comments, the substantive changes that they've recommended or called for, you know, have merit and are something that we would want to accept, this is where those might go and this is where they might fit. This document is not, you know, some sort of consensus that we as a sub-team came to and are recommending this is what it should look like. It's more, you know, I think when you looked at the summaries that we had kind of circulated 3 or 4 weeks ago, we thought this would help to kind of envision where those proposed changes might go. So that's why we, you know, included those bubbles to point out this is where those changes are coming from. But in any event, unless anybody has any objection, I'll just kind of walk through and explain kind of how these work and where they came from.
Mary's mentioning in the chat that they can't show Word doc comments in a PDF in the Adobe Connect room. So if you could, I think you can see the highlighted in white, so maybe you can people can follow along at home with the document that was sent out. And if you could mention those comments that are put in place. Having said that, please go ahead and walk us through what you guys have been working on, please.
Perfect. Will do. Thank you. And thanks, Mary. So the first is this inclusion by not requiring that disclosure automatically follow any given request. This was based on multiple comments that we reviewed, Black Knight, Key Systems, Google, Access Now, and then various individuals, Ralph Herring, Simon Kassain, et cetera, who basically argued that there should not be any kind of automatic requirement, but rather it should be some sort of discretion, et cetera. So we included this language in the preamble to kind of make that explicit. If you look at the structure of especially Section 3 that we'll get to, the only thing that's really required is that if a provider is deciding not to disclose, they have to provide their reasons for doing so. But just to address the point that these comments raised and to kind of make that explicit right up front, that's where that language comes from. The next proposed change came from a comment from CDT Open Technology, which basically just called for a review after a certain number of months or a certain amount of time had passed as to the efficacy of the balance that this framework is trying to strike. So that's where that comes from. And then as you scroll down, when we get to 1B3, we have this language about standard nominal cost recovery fee. As we pointed out in the little comment box and what we circulated, we reviewed 6 comments that were opposed to that language and 3 in support. And so, you know, we've excluded it here, but again, you know, some of the what this document reflects is, you know, obviously not final. And so to the extent that the working group as a whole decides to give more merit to the arguments included in the 3 comments as opposed to the 6, but that's why that's. We added the word vexatious to subsection 5, just per a comment from an individual, Nick O'Dell. We've highlighted 1D and just raised the question, does the working group need to revisit this per the 11 comments from the privacy campaign, which argue that everyone deserves the right to privacy and no one's personal information should be revealed without a court order. So there's no change there. It's just sort of a flag for further discussion. All right, 2A, we've added this verifiable evidence of wrongdoing, including kind of further down. You know, this was a contention both in our subteam and then in our working group on this particular that was to go now. Again, the document was not a courage if it the standard of verifiable evidence or something enumerated here to you know raise that point. But you know this is the place where it makes the most sense to include it, and so it's. 2B and 2C includes that new language taken directly from the Save Domain Privacy petition and, you know, then enumerates kind of what that might be. I see James has his hand up. Should I just go through the whole document and then come back, or should I pause and we can kind of discuss as we go? I'm open to either.
Let's take James's comment and we'll try and keep the comments relevant to the section we're discussing, I think is what's going to I hope will happen. We can move through that way. So if you're open to it, Todd, then we can hear from James.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks, Graham. Thanks, Todd. Just a question about the addition of the word vexatious. Can you give us just a little bit of background there on what drove that inclusion and what the impact of that is both from a legal and non-legal context?
Right, so that was based on the comment from Nick O'Dell, who in his comment just said there should be some prohibition against vexatious requests, basically. So we added that in terms of the, substantive work that word is doing and how it adds to frivolous or harassing. Frankly, I don't necessarily have a clear distinction on that. I mean, we could talk about it as a working group, what that means. I mean, do you have a concern about it?
No, not a concern. I was just unclear on what that, kind of what you just said. I was unclear on what that brought to the table that wasn't covered by frivolous or harassing. just thought it was already covered. Thanks. And mainly just making sure that there wasn't something that I was completely missing, that there was something, you know, I didn't go to law school. I didn't know if there was some secret legal meaning behind vexatious that I wasn't picking up on. Thanks.
Thanks, James. I also see Holly's got her hand up, too, so maybe we'll go to Holly.
Thanks. First, James, vexatious, just for those of us who have gone to law school, is this just a standard phrase about frivolous vexatious, and it just means either calls made without substance or something that is done with some kind of bad purpose in mind. It's such a standard phrase, I didn't even think about it. And I wouldn't be concerned about it. I would like to stress, though, in the addition of the phrase verifiable evidence of wrongdoing, that implies that everything that follows, the group has agreed, meets the test of verifiable evidence. And we sort of haven't got there yet, so this phrase is very much a placeholder, and it will require just a little bit more thought and discussion amongst the working group as to whether that stays there or not. Thank you.
Thanks, Holly. And I think it's pretty clear that we're going to need to spend a bit more time on that particular phrase and what that means to us and what we want that to mean going forward. So let's go back to Todd and continue working our way through the documents. And I'm not sure if that discussion around defining that term is going to be something we do on this call or if it's something we add to our list of issues we need to come back to. Todd, if you could continue.
Great. So back in 2A, a change to 2A2 and adding the words if any, and that was in response to a comment from RIAAIFPI specifically wanting to make explicit that use of a previous relay function was not required. So that's what work those are doing. 2A5, addition of if applicable twice per multiple comments that we reviewed, and then addition of and the date of first use and or of application and registration of the mark per a comment that we received from an individual, Tim Kramer. The if applicable is in response to comments arguing that common law marks ought to be eligible for this system in addition to those for which that are registered. And then the date of first use from this comment from Tim Kramer about wanting to include that in what it is that the requester is providing, such that if the registrant has priority, has had the domain name before then, that's something that they could point out in their response. All right, 2A6B is substantially reworked, and this is you're going to see again in 2B and 2C, and this was per comments from the NCSG and Cyber Invasion. Basically, the requester would have to aver or kind of agree to certain things in the request as far as what they will do with whatever information they are given once they've got it. So one is to only use it to determine whether further action is warranted to resolve the issue, to attempt to contact the customer, or in a legal proceeding. And that was already in there. It's just all been moved to the first kind of section. And then 2 and 3 are now new. One is to only retain it for as long as is necessary to achieve whatever it is they're doing in the first section. And then the third is to comply with whatever applicable data protection laws while they have it. So for 2B, some of the changes are repetitive of what we just talked about in 2A, so I won't go into those again. I will highlight the ones that are new. The first is a change to 2B1 per a comment from the RIAAIFPI about the exact URL where the allegedly infringing work is located, or a representative sample or where such work is located. I've got two hands. I think I'll stop.
Yeah. That last point is curious. I'm not exactly sure what that would mean. I would be interested in an example if anyone knows what the RIA was specifically mentioning there. And then I see Steve and James. Steve?
Yeah, this is Steve Metalitz, and I was a little slow getting my clicking on the hand there. But I really was going back to this these changes to 6B. And I guess because we have James Gannon on the call and we have others from NCSG on the call, so maybe they can explain what was meant by requiring compliance with all applicable data protection laws while retaining customers' contact details. Is this a security concern, or I'm just not sure what that is exactly, what that's driving at. So any explanation of that would be great.
Well, it looks like we've got James with his hand up.
Cyber invasion.
Yep. I see James with his hand up right after you. So, and cyber invasion, I think, is James Gannon. So let's hear from him.
Yes, James. Thanks. So James Gannon. So yeah, I was the drafter of the NCSG section on this, and I'm also the drafter of the cyber invasion comments on this. So, given that we're writing a global policy, we needed to take into account that in certain jurisdictions, the requester will be taking on the role of a data controller, particularly under EU legislation and some South American legislations as well around data privacy. So there was a need to reflect that within the policy that in certain jurisdictions, and probably, you know, can be applicable worldwide, that there may be applicable data protection laws that the requester and the provider need to be aware of as they are processing what can be considered personal data. So that was the justification behind looking for language around that. Dealing in the cyber invasion comments, and I believe it might have been in the NCSG comments, and I'd like to, it may be somewhere else, and there should be something in here, I believe, around ensuring that secure transmission methods are used to convey personal information between the provider and the requesting party if disclosure is required, that, you know, there is a minimum set of security standards that it will be abided to by those two parties to ensure that there's no potential data loss of PII during the process.
Thanks, James. That last piece is interesting. I'd be curious to hear from other providers on that and whether they do encrypted communications for this sort of thing currently, and whether or not that would be arduous to set up. I see Susan, then Holly, then James. Susan, please, go ahead.
So I'm curious about B2, 6B2, only retain customers' contact details for as long as is necessary. And I apologize, James, but somehow you're, when you were speaking, it was sort of fuzzy on my phone, so you may have addressed this. But is that something, you know, I mean, there's a lot of different jurisdictions, so if I'm requesting that information and have received it from a specific proxy vendor, is the proxy vendor going to inform me of those of the time span that I can retain that data, and then exactly how to delete that data?
That's a good question, Susan. I don't know if that would fall under the data protection laws or whether we want to specify, but I don't know how we could because we don't know how long whatever processes take place. And certainly I wouldn't expect a service provider to understand for each jurisdiction that they might be dealing with how long those rules are. So I would think it's up to the requester, but I don't know how that is enforceable. I see James with his hand up, and then James Gannon. James Gannon, are you responding directly to that question?
And yes, if you don't mind. Am I actually audible now?
That seems a little better to me.
The booming voice of God. So I actually agree with the wording that has been set out in 62. So we're making a reference to 6E1 up there to say that. So in certain jurisdictions, yes, there would be a requirement that customer data or PII is not retained for a period greater than the use of the actual data. So in an attempt to have a situation where there is some flexibility for multiple jurisdictions and for requesters that will be dealing with multiple providers, and in an attempt to have a policy that's workable on a global scale, I think having the statement in there that it's as long as necessary achieve the objectives of, for example, Section 1-2. So basically, once you've resolved the issue, the requester would then no longer retain that data. So I think that would be a broad policy statement that would work at a global level. Now, requesters in their own jurisdictions will obviously have to adhere to their national laws, but that's not something that I think we should be going down the road of. But for example, if we had an IP firm here in Ireland, they would obviously have to adhere to Irish data protection legislation, which would mandate that you would have up to about 60 days to destroy the data after that. But we need to allow in a global policy some flexibility for individual requesters to adhere to their national guidelines. But as a base level, I think the wording as we have it at the moment, which is the as necessary to achieve the objectives, I think that's a good enough statement for a global policy.
Thanks, James. I'd be curious to hear from other people as to whether they think that flexibility in the language we've got there is going to be sufficient. I've got James Bladel and then Steve Metallitz. James?
Hi, James Bladel speaking. Thanks. And some of my questions or comments have already been covered, but I'm just kind of still reacting to the specifics presented by 6B2 and 6B3. I wanted to make sure that we're being sufficiently explicit, perhaps in 6B1 even, about what is not permissible on the part of the complainant in terms of the use of this contact information. For example, storing it, collecting it in a database, aggregating complaints over time, and then, publishing that to third parties or even just putting it out in the general public. And then I think that what I would be more comfortable seeing, because of the concerns where, and I think James touched on this, where we have a complaining party in one jurisdiction, privacy provider in, let's say, the U.S., where there are no specific data protection laws, and then the customer being in a third jurisdiction. I think I'd like to see some language that specifically says something along the lines of the customer, the complainant will indemnify the privacy service provider against any misuse of the data. And I think that that would be key because, or at least allow a carve out so that that could be included in the provider's terms and conditions for filing a complaint. My concern here is that we're creating a loophole where it'll be like a slow leak, and eventually the services will be collected and tabulated over a number of complaints, and that data will be misused. Thanks.
Thanks, James. I suspect the idea of an indemnification might be a hard sell, but perhaps there is language that we can come to there that sort of addresses both James Gannon's concerns and yours there. Let's hear from Steve.
Yeah, thanks. This is Steve Metallitz. My concern was really with the practicalities of this, which I think have already been raised a bit. But and so I guess I'd just like to ask the following of the proponents. So let's say that I'm a complainant. I do obtain the contact details after going through this process. And I either try to contact the customer, can't reach them, and decide not to pursue it, or I contact the customer, and possibly the problem is resolved, or in other words, I do what number one says. Then number two, in the future, I make a second complaint about a second domain name, and it turns out that that's the same registrant. I go through the same process, and the same registrant's name comes up. Now, would I be able to actually associate those two and note that this is somebody who is where the issue has arisen twice, and that might make a difference for me in determining what action to take? But it almost sounds as if I have to forget about the first one and purge that from my records, and therefore just assume that this person has never, the issue has never been raised before with regard to this registrant. Is that what's intended here? And if so, why?
That's a good point, Steve.
Yeah.
I would think that using the language we've got there, you would be able to keep the registrant name. It's just the contact details. So you would still possibly be able to relate those, but you may not have that full record from the who is.
I guess that's a possible reading of this, but my problem there is, of course, that the person just uses a different name, but maybe all the contact details are the same, and that's the way that you know that it's the same and same person. So I'm just asking what two is intended to prevent. I understand it's intended to prevent James Bledel's scenario of going into the business of, selling databases of bad actors or something, but from the viewpoint of a complainant who's not interested in that business but just interested in protecting their intellectual property rights, it just seems this could really hamper efforts in that scenario. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. I see James Gannon's got his hand up, and then also Susan. So let's go to James Gannon.
I'll very briefly respond. So I understand Steve's point, and I accept that is a business issue for the requesting parties. However, we need to accept that in a global policy, we need to be observant of individual data protection legislations and the various jurisdictions that we're working under. I would see data retention issues with retaining data in that manner. While providing a method by which IP requesters can request this personal information is something that I think is obviously a thing that the group has decided that we need. I don't believe that we've made the step from requesting that information to allowing the requesters to compile that information, be it even for internal purposes within their own companies. We don't need to always go to the example of, selling a database of customer information. Even for internal purposes, we haven't made that leap to say that we're also going to enable that. And I think if we are going to make that leap, then that's a discussion that we need to have in the working group, that if we're going to enable that, even in internal database development, we need to have a wider discussion over that point. But I accept Steve's press. It would be a business issue for.
Thanks, James. Susan.
So back to the point two of this only retain customers' contact details for as long as is necessary. When there are security issues on the internet, that Facebook is usually one of the many targets. We share information all the time, so with other security departments, because then we can act in a unified manner. So I'm assuming that if I request proxy the underlying data for a proxy registration, and then but I'm working on an issue that has that is obviously targeted several major companies, which is really not targeting the company. The companies, it's targeting users. And so if I, find out one piece of the puzzle and share that with other major security departments, is that going to be a violation of the request process?
That's a good question, Susan. I think as we have it right now, it quite possibly is.
Okay, and then the follow-up is, if I share it, then am I responsible, because I've requested it, to ensure that everybody that I shared that with, because this is a bad actor. This is someone who's basically, taking money from individuals. Am I responsible for ensuring that they then delete the data when when we've resolved that one issue?
I think you are responsible if you've shared it. Sorry if I'm editorializing. Because it's not proven that this is a bad actor. It sounds like at this point you've met a number of the requirements that we think it's possible that it certainly hasn't gone through a formal legal process to determine that's a bad actor. So I think there is a reasonable assumption of risk on your part that if you're going to take that information and share it, that you would have some responsibility for that information. James Gannon and James Plato. Feel free to respond.
Can I just add one more little element to that? So oftentimes when I am making a request to to a proxy provider or just to a registrar because they are hosting the content, then I forward that information, which is usually contact details, that connects domain names involved in a scam. I forward that back to a registrar. So is the registrar bound to then comply with all of this, what I've agreed to, and then delete the data that I've sent to them?
I'm not sure. Let's hear what James and then or other James and then James have to say. James Gannon.
Thanks, Ed. So there's two issues at hand here. So I agree with part of Susan's point, but we have to remember that Annex E here that we're talking about is for intellectual property infringement and not malicious use. So we haven't examined the framework releasing details due to malicious use. So they're two slightly different things. And also on the point of threat intelligence sharing, in my experience, and this is an area that I work extensively in, the majority of threat intelligence sharing and through ISACs and various other forms is more on the IP address side. So yes, there is some unofficial methods for sharing threat intelligence on registrants. However, it's not the heavily formalized area, and it's not something that's used widely enough, I believe, to be the subject of its own framework just yet. The majority of threat intelligence is based around IP addresses and non-bad actors within AS numbers and various other methods. There's not a huge amount of commercial work done on registrant threat intelligence, and I would have concerns about automatically assuming that a registrant is connected to one malicious domain name, that then automatically we're going to the other domains that have been used under the same registrant, because there's many issues. We talked about this before around involuntary hosting of malware and other issues. So we went into that in detail before, so I don't believe that it's really relevant to Annex E at the moment, but I accept that we may have to look at it in future under a security focused.
Hello? Anybody home?
Hi, this is... I think we've lost audio for Graham. Graham, if you're speaking, we can't hear you.
I don't see anybody else in the queue. So maybe... unless Graham's back, maybe we could ask Todd to just pick up with his walkthrough, because I think we've had a good discussion on this one topic.
Sure, this is Todd. Happy to do that. And just for the sake of time, I would propose we jump forward to Section 3, and specifically 3B, and then we'll kind of see how far we get on that. Ready there? That was odd. Okay. So 3B, four specific changes. The first is on the timing. We've replaced the X with 3 calendar days after receiving the customer's response or 1 calendar day after the time for customer's response has passed. In the document that we circulated, we noted there were alternative formulations. One was 14 days total. One was 10 days each, et cetera. So, I mean, we could debate which of those we think is appropriate, but those are all outlined there in the document for your consideration. The second proposed change is from Vanda Scartazzini, and the individual suggesting changing the language from shall to is encouraged but not required to. The third is the addition of using secure communication channels for how the disclosure actually happens, and that's per comments from NCSG, Cyber Invasion, and Reagan Lynch, who's an individual. And then the fourth is changing what is actually disclosed from the previous formulation, which was the contact information it has for customer that would ordinarily appear in the publicly accessible WHOIS for non-proxy privacy registrations, to name, mailing address, and contact information for service of process that it has for customer. And that was based on a public comment from an individual, Reed Baker, whose argument was that what was disclosed should track what would typically be available in a public records database if you were looking at, for example, a corporate entity. So I think I'll stop there because that's a lot of kind of substantive changes, and I assume we'll have discussion on some or all of those four.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Ooh, I wonder what happened there. That was curious. thank you, and thanks for stepping in there, Steve and Todd. I see James has got his hand up. Let's go right to James.
Thanks, Graham, and thanks, Todd. Just two quick points. First of all, those date ranges are, from an operational standpoint, probably unworkable. 3 calendar days or 1 calendar day, you know, even for a large registrar that has 24-hour teams responding to requests like this, I think we're probably going to miss, I don't know, 20 to 50% of requests outside of those windows. So that's comment number one. I think, you know, let's look to some of the other policies that exist that usually, I think, 5 calendar days is where they seem to land on a standard. And then the last one here, secure communication channels. I don't know how that could practically be established, you know, unless there were some developed portal for these disclosures. I'm concerned that that is also a pretty heavy lift to put on service providers and also, you know, on complainants. You know, I think that if, you know, if the request is made via email or via form, that it would be transmitted that way as well. And then finally, the information, you know, sending information that is a subset of or superset of the information that is included in the WHOIS record or would have otherwise been in the WHOIS record to me is not, you know, I feel like that's not really the purpose of this particular working group. I think that, you know, it's really just to just expose the information as if it would normally appear in WHOIS is the simplest and most straightforward approach to a disclosure. So those are just my reactions to Section B. Thank you.
Thanks, James. if I can respond myself, yeah, I can see James Gannon in the chat saying PGP encrypted email wouldn't be a big ask. I wish that were true. It's probably a bit of work. I don't, you know, unfortunately, it's not common. I wish all email was encrypted. That would make life better. But that's not the case, and I think that would require a fair amount of work to be able to communicate with people that way. And then the alternative is that we, you know, all providers end up having to build a sort of secure website to communicate back and forth with requesters and registrants. And that's a fair amount of development, and you want to make sure you get that right. So it raises the bar to offering these services in a way that might be problematic. I see Steve Metallitz and Val in the queue. Steve?
Yeah, thanks. Steve Metallitz here. I would agree with what James, two of James's points about secure communication channels and about the last change here to be little one. I actually wanted to mention the one change he didn't talk about, and that's this change to Vonda's suggestion to change it from the service provider shall do one of these things to encourage but not required to. I mean, I think this is kind of motivated by something, you know, it's really goes back to the very first change that Todd walked through, that to make it clear that you're not there isn't any automatic disclosure under this system. I think that's what's motivating this, because read literally, this really just would make this a worthless template, because the expectation, the whole idea here is if you put certain things, information forward in your request, you're going to get an answer, either yes or no. Either the information is going to be disclosed or it's not going to be disclosed and a reason will be given. So to say that that the service provider doesn't have to do either one of these things after receiving the complaint and forwarding it to the customer and getting the customer's response back, and then they don't have to do any, you know, say anything, I think that would kind of eliminate the purpose of this. So I think I would have to oppose that second change in B. I think it really results probably from a misreading or misunderstanding of this, and I think it really goes more to the issue of whether there should be automatic disclosure. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve, and that seems pretty reasonable to me. We'll see if anybody else objects, but I can see Bladel in the chat is agreeing. I will also support James's comment that three calendar days is probably not enough time. Five is far more sensible. Val, please.
Thanks, Graham. This is Val. I'll make this very brief, as Steve just said precisely what one of my concerns is about this encouraged but not required section. It would, in fact, it seems to me, nullify these standards altogether. So keeping it brief, would have to object to that as well. Thanks.
Thanks, Val. I see James Gannon in the queue again. James?
Not surprisingly, I would support the retention of the encouraged to but not required to language. I think that giving providers some flexibility in this area would be a useful tool for the acceptance of Vanity by the greater public and by the commenters, essentially looking to get rid of Annexy entirely. I think this would be a way to make it a little bit more palatable, and I think that take into account the fact that we have many, many people who didn't want Annexy at all anymore, so we need to retain that flexibility. As long as, for example, James said in the comments there, that as long as we're keeping their ability to refuse, that we're not going to an automatic disclosure process, then we might be okay. So we need to be careful with how we tweak language in this area.
Thanks, James. I have a sense that I think we're covered there, that we've retained the flexibility, and so reinforcing it here in 3B is perhaps not required. We've got about 14 minutes left and still a good chunk more of this document to go. So I want to see if we can get through the rest of it before we end the call. Val, is that an old hand? Nope. Yes, it was. Okay, Todd, if you could continue, please. We'll move on from this point and keep going.
Great. So next 3C, several different things to highlight. 2 and 3, these are sections where in our initial report we have put out two alternative formulations of what the language ought to be and basically received more public comments in favor of what is now here included as opposed to the alternative formulation. And so that's just reflected in 2 and 3. In 4, per the comments from NCSG and Cyber Invasion, there is language that is added making this a requirement that basically surrender in lieu of disclosure is not just an option, but is something that is available across the board. And then there is a new subsection 6 added per comments from CDT, Open Technology, NCSG, and Cyber Invasion, basically tracking the language of 5 customers provided or provider has found specific information, facts, or circumstances, but then adding this part about showing that disclosure to the requester will endanger the safety of the customer. So there's a lot substantively there. I think we ought to stop there and probably talk about those.
Thanks, Todd. I put myself in the queue just to see if we have any sort of clarity on what it would mean to surrender the domain. Is that mean the domain transfers in ownership to the service provider, or are we deleting the domain? Do we need more clarity on that, or is just surrender satisfactory text? Is my question to others? I also don't see any other hands in the queue, so pending more of that, then perhaps we carry on.
All right, just moving on.
I'm sorry, I inspired Holly and Steve to get in the queue there. So, Holly?
I admit surrender is not the best word. I think the idea was if the end customer simply does not want their name revealed, does not want it, recognizes that their information may be revealed, they should be given the option of just saying, look, I just want to give up the whole thing. I do not want to be contacted at all. I give up my service. And I don't know the proper words for that. That's what's being aimed at.
Okay. Thanks, Holly. Steve?
Yeah, this is Steve Metallitz. I would kind of defer to what I want to hear what the service providers think about number 4 there, because we had this discussion before about whether this should be the mandatory policy. My question actually goes to 6 and whether is that a subset of what we already have there in 5 about the pretext, or is there anything that wouldn't, you know, would fall out? Can we substitute 6 for 5, or is there something? How much overlap is there between these, and how much congruence is there between these two reasons? So I guess I would just, you know, ask that I guess that's from CDT and Open Technology, NCSG, Cyber Invasion. So if anybody wants to comment on that, thanks.
Steve and James, you guys have a good here's my question lined up for response process today. 9 minutes left, and we still have a bit more document to get through. So, James, if you could respond, but with haste, please.
With haste. Me and Steve are in sync across the Atlantic. So on the surrendered its domain name, I would not support transferring the domain name to the complaining party. That opens up security considerations that will need to be addressed as well. On the merging of 5 and 6, as long as we retain the additional text, I would have no issue with merging those into a single section, but that additional text, I think, is clarification that's required.
Okay. Thanks, James. I see James Bladel just hopped in the queue, and I think that's an old hand from Steve. I would think that those domains end up deleted, the ones that are surrendered, because I would be very surprised if a service provider is responsible for them. James Plato?
Yeah, just real quickly, deletion is the one here. We can't write a policy for service providers assuming that they are also registrars, because a service provider would not have the ability necessarily to transfer the name to third party. That would be either a function of a registrar or some other, or reseller or some other intermediary. So just wanted to make sure that we're focused on surrender is deletion. Thanks.
Thanks, James. All right. We need to think a little bit more about 5 and 6 there and whether they overlap enough as per Steve's question, but let's hear from Todd and see if we can get through the rest of this.
Sure, real quick. So 3D, in what you were looking at in Adobe, you won't see any changes. We didn't touch the language, but in the document that we circulated, we just noted in the comment box that we received comments on both sides, basically, of 3D. 3F is deleted. That was per multiple comments that we received expressing concerns about certain aspects of the appeal process that we had outlined. But basically, though those concerns came from opposite sides, essentially, of that process, whether it was not too robust, et cetera, they tended to merge in the sense of just suggesting that it be scrapped, and so that's why that's the way that it is. And then 3G, you know, we had put two potential options out for comment on the annex and received more comments in support of option 2 than option 1, so that's why that's drafted the way that it is. But as you'll see in the kind of comment box that we included in the draft that we circulated, there was really not very much commentary on kind of either side of that. I think it was maybe two comments to one or three to one, and so I would just flag that as kind of an issue for kind of further discussion among the working group. And then that's it.
Thanks, Todd, and thanks again to you and your whole sub-team for working through these issues and presenting them today. There's been a lot of good discussion. So I see we've got about 6 minutes left here. I don't think we're going to get into part three of the public comment review tool, though I would say that next week's call is going to be last call for issues from part three. Do we have any thoughts on these last couple sections that Todd has raised for us here, or the where we're at with this entire document? Would like to hear those now. We've got a few minutes left. I see Steve's got his hand up.
Yes, thank you, Steve Metallitz, and I would just echo what you have said about this sub-team's work. I think that you've really advanced the ball here considerably with these with this markup. Just looking at this Annex 1, Annex to the Annex, about what happened, resolving disputes about, the title may not be exactly right. I think as we think about this, you have to go back to the section we talked about before about using the customer's contact details only for certain purposes and how long you retain them and so forth. Because I think what was intended here in the original draft was that this annex would give the two options for how you resolve complaints arising from misuse of the material as well as false statements made in order to obtain the contact information. I don't think our title in the annex was quite right there. So it just to point out that this whole question of what process is put in place, if you go back to G, it's based on false information, but then the question is, what about the misuse of the information? How is that covered? So just to say that as we discuss that, we need to keep both those in mind. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. 4 minutes left, and we've got James and Holly in the queue, so you've got 2 minutes each, tops. James?
Thanks, Graham. I'll be very brief. Thanks again to Todd and the working group for their work on this. Going all the way back to page 2, which is section B3. I'd like to put a marker down for our future conversations that the deletion of 1B3 is something that we need to discuss a little bit further. I realize that some commenters do not want there to be a fee associated with filing or resolving complaints or requests of this nature. However, that does not change the operational reality that service providers will either have to hire people to process these requests or repurpose existing employees. So the cost is real, and it's not going away. And, in fact, we can expect that it will increase significantly with the adoption of these accreditation frameworks. So I just want to put a marker down for that section that we need a further discussion on 1B3. Thank you.
Thanks, James. Fair enough. Holly?
Yeah, I also want to put a marker in, and it's just against, again, that phrase, verifiable evidence. We as a group need to have a little bit more discussion on that, and then the group itself needs to have a bit of a discussion on that.
Great. Thanks, Holly. I can see that Mary just captured that there. And so that is a discussion that we should figure out where we've got time for and have that relatively shortly. 10:58, I think that'll wrap up this call. Todd and subteam, again, great work. Thank you very much. And that was, I think, a productive discussion today. We've flagged some issues for clarification. None of it to me is terrifying, so that's always positive. We'll see you next week. Let's make sure to have a bit more discussion on the list. It's been a little quiet. And again, last call for issues arising from Part 3 of the comment review tool. Thanks, everybody. Have a wonderful Tuesday.
Thanks, Graham.